Good morning. So the way I'm going to run this is I'm going to take a bunch of questions and then answer them in some order, hopefully group by topic. And then if we run out of questions, I'll maybe take a second run of questions if we have time. Otherwise, we'll finish up. So questions, just raise a hand, things you want me to talk about.
Inheritance,
Virtual keyword, okay. Other topics. Okay, other topics?
Like just memory leaks, maybe like where they occur, like actual memory.
Okay. Okay, maybe you'll think of some later, so let's group these by topic area. So, start from inheritance and the virtual keyword. So, hopefully, you remember a little bit about inheritance from prior courses. So, class A inherits from class B. The C++ syntax for that is B. That means that A has B's member variables. You might also know as instance variables. A has B's member functions, which you might also know as methods, and not the other way around. And A's constructor calls B's constructor first.
Does it have its private methods too, and private variables?
Yes, so including private. No, but A can't access the privates. And the same is true for methods. A meaning A's functions and friends of A and so on. So this is all the same as Java. So in Java, effectively all methods are what C++ calls virtual. If I have class A extends B, and I have a public void foo, and class B had a public void foo, then given B foo equals new A, or B bar equals new A, bar dot foo, in Java, always calls a.foo. In C++, methods are declared. Virtual works as above. So, e.g., if we have a class B with a public void foo, and we have a class A which inherits from B with a foo, then it works as above. If it's not declared, virtual only calls what the type says. So if we have same situation without the virtual keyword, and we do B star bar equals new A bar foo always calls B foo, not A foo. Though if we had, say, and this is because of the type of the value we're using. So for example, if I have original foo here, this always, this of course, this will still call A foo. Yes?
What if you said A's foo is also virtual?
What if I said A foo is also virtual here? So above, so in both cases, it doesn't make a difference. So in the case up here, it doesn't make a difference because unless I'm calling something through a type of A. So virtual, yeah, so what matters is whether the type you are using has the virtual method. We're using has the virtual method. So if I'm using a B star, it matters whether B has the virtual method. If I'm using an A star, it matters whether A has the virtual method. Usually the convention would be that you would declare it is virtual every time, assuming you wanted people to be able to inherit from the class. So that's the, so this is one use of the virtual keyword. So this is virtual methods. There's another use of the virtual keyword, which was virtual inheritance. And this is an unfortunate case, like many, where C++ uses the same keyword for two things which are rather different. So there are two options for, virtual inheritance comes because of multiple inheritance, and there are two ways we can do multiple inheritance. So, two choices. So, choice one is duplicate the base class. Multiple. Duplicate the multiple inheritance. I guess I should be clear. Only matters for multiple inheritance for inheriting the same base class multiple times, which is a special case of multiple inheritance. And this is exactly where diamond inheritance comes in. So there's two choices. So we can duplicate the base class. This means that there are two copies. So if we have, for example, base with a int A, I have one So if we have this, this will duplicate the base class, meaning that grandchild's layout is going to have contain child 1, 1's base A, and child 2's base A. And if we, for example, have a boo and a bar, this is what foo axis is, uses A, and this is what bar axis is when it uses A. And these are two distinct variables, even though they have the same name. And this, you know, the idea is that base class is helping implement its immediate child. Generally, when this is being used. So we're having some variables the base class is storing to help implement the class which inherited from it. And it might be being used for a different purpose. And we saw the example in class where like it was used to implement a linked list node. And different base classes that we use for this grandchild had different linked lists they'd want to be on. And choice two is share the base class. So in that case, we'd have I think we did it this way, thing like this, and our grandchild has a single shared A, and this is what this is for the use cases more like what we, you know, class is a common interface used by anyone using the class. E.g., so here our example was e.g. linked list node for type of object, type of child. And here the example would be something like comparable. Like if there's any metadata the comparable or serializable, like it should apply to the whole object. It's not just something to help implement the base class. This is an interface for people calling us. This is more like the multiple inheritance you're used to, like in Java, where you have an interface. And the idea is that there's this common API provided for that object, no matter what multiple things it might be using. So this case is no virtual keyword, alt, and this case is the virtual keyword. And this is the other use of the virtual keyword, which is basically, you know, we learned that the implementation, you know, both of these uses a virtual table, but like from a usability perspective, like you think of these as completely different things. Okay, so any questions about, yes?
So for the duplicated inheritance, how would you go about accessing child 1's base A?
So the question is, how would you access each of these two fields? So if I have a grandchild pointer P, I can get a child 1 pointer from it. And then this 1A is that value. And there may be other ways of doing this that are maybe more compact, but that's one way that would work.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember, like, when you look in memory, like at the bottom of the assembly files where like the virtual table was stored and it had the different virtual methods, is that what the table looks like?
So the question is, what does the virtual table look like? So it has pointers to each of the virtual methods, yes, because when we do a call like this, we have to look up, you know, We don't know what type bar actually is. We have to look that up. And when you did, if you did virtual inheritance, which you may have not ever done and looked at the assembly output, you would also have typically an offset to indicate where you find the shared base class.
So we just have to check the virtual table checks the type and then assigns the or like finds the correct function for that type.
Yeah. So the virtual table basically there's a different virtual table depending on what type it is. So you can think of the virtual table tells you everything you need to know about the type of object you have. Yeah.
What happens if child 1 and child 2 have the same method name?
So what happens if child 1 and child 2 have the same method name? I do not actually know offhand what the rules for that case are. Like, you shouldn't do it, but I think... So I know that the grandchild can define a method with the same name and explicitly call either child 1's method with that name or child 2's. I don't know what happens if you don't do that. Okay, so next question was types of pointers. So pointers. So in this class, we learned about, you know, pointers as we have some type star x. And the some type is part of the type of the pointer in that case. X is a pointer to some type. In memory, it's just a memory address. But the pointer type matters for some reasons. But so size of star x uses the type it points to. X of 10 uses the type it points to. This is because it needs to know, like, e.g., skip ahead. Size of x, size of some type times 10 bytes memory, because it needs to skip ahead of memory to find the array element 10 by taking into account the size of the type being pointed to. And of course, if we do call some method, obviously this uses the type it points to, otherwise we have no idea even if that method exists or is valid. But, or if we try to get some member variable. So those are the big things where the type of a pointer matters, even though in assembly, conceptually, it's just a number we're passing around. The other confusing case for people is that we can have pointers to pointers. And this is this x is a pointer to some type. And the same sort of rules apply here. So size of star x uses the type it points to, which is a size of a pointer to type. And similarly, trying to call a method on that is an error because you're not dereferencing enough. You're getting a pointer and trying to call a method on it directly. It doesn't have methods. And I guess the other confusing case we had was this, which is not a type of pointer. This is
Instead of just using the actual object itself, because at that point you're using the actual object, right?
So a reference to a pointer is sort of is closest to a pointer to a pointer.
Okay.
And the main advantages for using it versus a pointer to a pointer are that the syntax is different. Mostly. The other difference is that you can't change where the reference points to.
Okay.
which pointer the reference points to, and you can't for the pointer.
I saw a question that was like, how many pointers could you have before you were like running out of memory? And all the pointers are going right onto the heap. Is that correct? Like, a pointer in memory is going to be somewhere on the heap that's being allocated with.
So the question is, where is a pointer stored? So this is the same answer as for where is like an int stored. So if I have x, this is stored on the stack, probably. Stack or in a register. Same thing if I have a pointer. Exact same thing. And if I do if I allocate something dynamically, then dinx is stored on the stack or in a register. And what dinx points to is stored on the heap. And if I dynamically allocate a pointer, the same applies. So both of them could be on the stack or on the heap. Okay, so memory leaks, where do they happen? So the rule of thumb is every new oh, smart pointers. We'll add the, okay, so smart pointers. We didn't talk much about these. So smart pointers are classes which act like pointers. So they are wrap a pointer and try to help you manage it better. So one example was unique pointer. Unique pointer acts like a pointer, but automatically deletes it from its destructor. And we had share pointer acts like a pointer, but counts the number of shared pointers and deletes from destructor, assuming the count becomes zero. So these are all work by overriding operators. So they define operators telling, operator to reference, and operator. Operator arrow, so you can use them like a pointer, just like defining operator plus lets you use something like something you can add to. Pointer, have special constructors, destructors, basically, to manage the property they're supposed to have. And I'm guessing, okay, it makes sense that was what meant by types of pointers. Okay, so memory leaks. Are there more questions on types of pointers? Okay, so memory leaks, where they happen. So the rule is must delete what is new. Typical problems are objects which are referenced, which are used in multiple places, this is. So I'm clear where to delete. Replacing object, changing where a pointer points without deleting the object it used to point to. We saw that example with the string cat allocating new space and then allocating over, replacing that pointer without deleting the old one. And just forgetting delete in simple cases. Delete, e.g. in a destructor. E.g. forgetting delete or just not writing a destructor. Questions about so decimal to floating point.
Where do they happen, like actually in memory? On the, they're on the heap, right? Like anything that's dynamically allocated.
Okay. Yeah. Always. So yeah. So yeah. With new malloc C memory. Yeah. So since they, I just said it's always new or malloc, it turns out it's always heap memory. Like with stack memory, goes away when function returns. It gets cleaned up eventually. So decimal to floating point. So usually there are multiple ways of thinking about converting decimal to floating point. But if you have something like 1.125 and you want to convert it to floating point, I guess we should use a probably example like 2.25. First step is to convert it to binary. So we have 10 plus 0.125, 10 base 2 plus 0.125, because I convert the 2, and I can say, okay, that's going to be 10.0 base 2. And I can say, well, so I can say we subtract 1.255 minus 2 gives us 10. And then we say, can we subtract 1? No, so there's nothing here. Can we subtract 0.5? No. Can we subtract 0.25, 1/4? So, no, so there's nothing there. Can we subtract 0.25 divided by 2, which is 0.125, yes. So there's something there. So the rule is repeatedly try subtracting 2 to the 0, 2 to the k, 2 to the k minus 1, 2 to the k minus 2, until it's not bigger. So we got this number. Another thing we could have done is we could have divided this into make it closer to get a fraction. So okay, I'll show that exact. But given that step, equals 0. So this is the base 2, 2.125. And then we want to make scientific notation. So we convert that to scientific notation, and which is going to have the form 1. Mantissa times 2 to the x, 2 to the exponent. And here that means we're going to shift over 1, so we move the, we go from 1.01 to 1.0001. So, and because we shifted over by 1, we have times 2 to the 1. 2 to the 1. And step 3 is going to be to, adjust for the bias. So we know, let's say we have a bias of, e.g., I think single precision is 127 because that's 2 to the, I actually need to look this up. Make sure I don't get this wrong. Is, 127. So if we're doing single precision, we have, this is 2 to the x minus 127 equals 1, which implies that our x is going to be 128. And then we convert parts to floating point numbers. So we have a sine anticipates single precision. We have 23 bits, and then x, or not in that order, exponent bits after the sine. In single precision, we have 7, 8.
So the exponent's gonna be 128.
Yeah, that's the value of the exponent because we have the middle, approximately the middle, and it's 1 minus a power of 2 is the bias. That's what the IEEE rule is generally. So our sine is 0. Plus, and then we have our exponent bits, which are going to be 128. Should remember the appropriate. So, and then our mantissa bits, we copy from 1, and then we add a whole bunch of zeros. And this is, so the question is, this is a big endian. I'm going to avoid saying whether list of bits are in any particular endianness, but because I could number them either from either direction, but this is but this side is the most significant bit, and this side is the least significant bit when written as a 32-bit integer. And so there's an alternate approaches are write as a binary fraction, as a fraction of the form x over x divided by 2 to the y. So in this case, we started with 2.125. We can say if we multiply times 2.125 over 1 times 8 over 8, we get 17 over 8. And we can then convert to 2 to the z times x over 2 to the y prime, where x over 2 to the y prime is between 1 and 2. And this is, we want the Mantis, One Point Mantissa parked. Patient to use. So this value here is what we want for the One Point Mantissa, because that's going to be between 1 and 2. So if we do that here, we say, okay, if we take, so if we take 2 to the minus 1, so we take 1 over 2 times, or sorry, in this case, positive 2 over 1 times 17 sixteenths, that's going to be the same as 17 eighteenths. And this gives us 17 sixteenths times 2 to the 1, which is exactly, and if we convert 17 sixteenths to binary, so we, that's going to be, that's 1, 0, that's 1 over 100, which gives us 1.001 times 2 to the 1. Sorry, that's a little... So this makes sense. So I'm converting to something over 2 to the x and waiting for the last possible moment to convert that to scientific notation. So I'm first figuring out how to remap it so it maps between 0, 1, and 2, which is what you want the... Well, you want this, or this first part of the scientific notation to be like, as a fraction, and then I'm converting that fraction back to binary floating point, binary, a binary decimalish number. Okay. Any questions about floating point conversion? Okay, so adjacency list versus matrices. So adjacency list means that I have a, that I have a, for every vertex, conceptually, I have a linked list of pointers to other vertices, basically. I should say probably like vertex names, something like that. An adjacency matrix, I have, and this map might be an array, really. Might really be an array. I guess I should just use a generic list because we could use any kind. Be an array, names are 0, 1, 2, n. Most commonly, we'll choose our vertex names to be 0 through n, so we can just use an array instead of like something like hash table. An adjacency matrix, my vertex names are 0, 1, 2, 3, n minus 1. I have a matrix n minus 1 and n, where matrix true if, only if there is an edge from ij from I to j. J. And extension for both is storing weights, weights, etc., in addition to vertex names or booleans.
What is the situation where one is preferred to the other?
Okay, the preference, so adjacency list is more compact if the number of edges is much less than the number of vertices squared. So in the sense that maximum number of edges is the number of vertices squared.
Why is that?
It was order the number of vertices squared. Because you can have, if in a directed graph, you can have, it's n times n minus 1.
Okay.
So it's not exactly vertices squared, except if you include self-edges, but when it's much less than that, like an adjacency list is more compact. And iterating takes time proportional to number of edges plus number of vertices, whereas for an adjacency matrix, iterating takes time proportional to number of vertices squared. So that's not worth it if the number of edges is not close to. But an adjacency matrix is more compact, the number of edges is close to the number of vertices squared. Just because practical issues, linked list pointers, etc. Also, easy to check in edges and out edges. As easy, I should say. And whereas with an adjacency list, checking for incoming edges requires iterating through all the lists. And practically, if needed, when people actually want to do that for and have an adjacency list matrix, often create a reverse adjacency list. Like when people want to do that for real, they'll often like go through all the vertices once to create a reverse version of the adjacency list. But that, but that's something you do when you care about all of them, you still have to go through everything. With an adjacency matrix, like you can easily say, let's look at everything and see if it has an edge to me. Edge to this particular vertex as a one-off, that's fast. Other questions on adjacency list versus matrix? Okay, so shortest path algorithm. So the big one we cared about was Dijkstra. Dijkstra's algorithm, we had breadth first search as a special case of this one. And the basic idea is start with a vertex. And every time we process a vertex, we're going to iterate through the vertices edges, update use that edge to update distance from the starting vertex to the edge's destination. Vertex, say 0. And so that's what we do when we process a vertex. And what vertices do we process? And we repeatedly process the vertex with the lowest distance, the unprocessed vertex with the lowest distance. So we start with the vertex, set its distance to 0. Now we're going to say, what's the unprocessed vertex with the lowest distance? Well, it's that starting vertex because it has 0. Everything else, we don't have a distance set, or we have a distance of infinity. and we look at all its edges, and we use that to update the distances of other vertex. And the rule is new distance equals sources current vertexes plus edge weight plus the edge's distance. And okay, and time complexity. So we had to iterate through all vertices to set distances. Iterate through essentially all edges to update distances. And updating distances was a priority queue decrease min. And it turned out that this is the operation which dominated our runtime. So we ended up with with the best possible choice of priority queue, we ended up with v plus e log v. We also had to iterate through all vertices removing from priority queue. And with a less good priority queue, that also took log v time, so we ended up with another refactor. So with a binary heap, we had the v log v factor from time from delete min. And I know I've listed these things as if we did things in this order, but we obviously don't, because in going through all the edges is interleaved with taking vertices off the priority queue. Okay, and finally, big O, big theta, big omega. So big O. So big O is upper bound, usually much easier to find. And you know, if something is big O of n, big O of x, and x is good enough, it's good enough. Good enough, and often confused with used when people really mean big theta. If you like read things in the real world, often people will say big O, but they really mean big theta. They really mean, or something like big theta or something like it. Big theta, they might mean like it's not big theta, but it's the best known bound we have, both upper and lower, upper bound we have. So big omega is lower bound. This is doesn't practically much except that you might need to reject something, because it's a lower bound. And this is good for knowing if some alternative, if some idea can get any better. So often, trivial lower bounds, e.g., min is minimum of unsorted list is big omega, or I guess median, for example, of an unsorted list is big omega of n, you have to examine every element. Like, that's a trivial bound, and that tells you that implies if you have a omega, a theta of n or big O of n median algorithm don't bud. Don't, no sense in trying to do better. Like big omega is good for that idea. And it's trivial to figure out that median of unsorted list is omega of n because you have to look at every element in the list basic approximate to do it in the worst case. And big theta is the sort of tight bound. And this is, you know, tells you the most about the time, the complexity, but is the hardest to find in general. Like sometimes you have a practical algorithm where you won't be able to figure out what the big theta bound is, but you'll have an easier time finding a big O bound or a big omega bound. And that's practically speaking why you might use the others. The biggest reason is that like finding big theta is just not worth your time if the other bounds are good enough for saying this is a reasonable thing to do. Okay, and I think I'm out of time. I have office hours after this, otherwise, and later this week. And I think some of our TAs should, hopefully. Yeah. And yes, I will post these notes to, I'll link them off the slides page.